Good afternoon. My name is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform, and on behalf of our chairman, Jay Rockefeller, our co-chairman, Susan Collins, and the rest of our board, I want to welcome you to this program on the basics of Medicare. Before we get started, this is a live webcast, and so I'm able to say, at least for those of you in the room and tuned in now, that we want to recognize the fact that there are a lot of things going on outside of the scope of Medicare, including a set of events in Blacksburg, Virginia, that are being recognized with a statewide day of mourning in the Commonwealth of Virginia. It's a week when there have been a lot of sad happenings, and we want everyone to know that the families and friends and colleagues of those who have been so terribly adversely affected by the events at Virginia Tech are in our thoughts and in our prayers. We're going to be talking today about Medicare in the most basic terms. If Medicare is not the most popular government program in America, it's awfully close. It's also the program that the federal government spends more on than almost any other, $374 billion last year, or about $1.07 of every dollar spent by the federal government, and it helps some 44 million beneficiaries and their families. And it's been the subject of a great deal of high-profile attention right here in Congress over the last few years. We've had a new prescription drug benefit added and brought online last year. There have been struggles with payments to physicians and other providers, trying to preserve both access for beneficiaries and a level of budget discipline. There's been controversy over how much private health plans are paid by Medicare. There have been concerns over the long-term fiscal effects of health cost increases and the aging of baby boomers. This is a program with a lot of moving parts that touch a lot of people in this country, and therefore is of great concern to the policymakers in this town. We're particularly glad to have as our partner and co-sponsor in this briefing the Kaiser Family Foundation. Diane Rowland on my left, whom you'll hear from presently, is here from the foundation. And we want to welcome not only those of you here in the room, but once again to the congressional staff in the state and district offices who have been alerted to this program. And there are some selected reporters across the country as well who are tuned in. We want you to understand the basics of this important program as well, and we want to thank you for being a part of the discussion. Let me turn at this point to Diane Rowland from the Kaiser Family Foundation for her introductory remarks.
Thank you, Ed, and thank you all for coming to attend this briefing or for listening in on the webcast or from your offices across the country. Today is Medicare. On Monday, we did Medicaid, and I think one of the biggest issues in health policy is often the confusion between the Medicaid and the Medicare program. So today we're talking about the health care program for seniors and people with disabilities as opposed to Medicaid, which was the program for low-income individuals. However, as I know you'll hear today, there's a lot of interaction and overlap, especially in the population on Medicare that is low-income and also served by Medicaid. And also today, I think one of the things we want to stress and get across to you is that while much of the discussion around Medicare in the last 2 years has been around an issue called the Medicare drug benefit, the program is actually much broader, does much more, covers many more services, and has a lot of other issues related to the provider community that receives payments from the program to the population served for medical care and to some of the gaps in the program. And so I hope that our discussion today will help you to have a good framework for future policy discussions and answering constituent issues on the Medicare program, and we'll fill in some of the gaps in knowledge that you may have. As Ed said, we do these 101s because we think the basics are the most important piece of understanding where to move forward with programs and to answer questions about programs. So there is no question that you will ask that is too simple or too unsophisticated. Please let this session be one of a learning experience for you and education experience that can help to build a better knowledge base for the future. And I'm really glad we have such a great panel to be able to field your questions. And let's get on with the basics.
Thank you, Diane. Let me do a couple of logistics tasks before we hear from our presenters. There's a lot of background information in the package that you got on the way into the room, including speaker biographies that are more generous and lengthier than I'm going to be able to give them, introducing them. There are the PowerPoint presentations that they will be using. They're available for you in hard copy here in the room. Those of you who are on the webcast can go to allhealth.org, and you'll find all of the materials as well as the PowerPoint presentations, which we didn't have in hand in time to mail them to you, available on the website. If you are watching the webcast live, and something happens to your computer, you can always dial in on a conference call and hear the audio. That number is 866-710-0179 with a passcode of 264-110. Those instructions are on the website, allhealth.org, as well. So if you didn't copy all the numbers, go get them just in case. And, of course, if you're listening on the conference call and you want to watch the webcast, that's at kaisernetwork.org. And we urge you to take advantage of that. There'll also be a transcript of this meeting available on kaisernetwork.org in a few days. And there'll be an archived version of the webcast available tomorrow. One other note, at the appropriate time, once we've finished our formal presentations, we'll give you a chance to ask the questions that Diane was talking about. Those of you in the room have green cards you can fill out, and we encourage you to use those cards because we want to make sure that we get questions from both inside the room and outside the room. And there are some floor mics as well. Those of you who are around the country can either use an email to info@allhealth.org, or you can call 202-789-2300, and someone will write it down and get it to us. So was that as confusing as it was on Monday? Sorry about that. Let's get to the program. That will be a lot less confusing, I know. We have, as Diane noted, a terrific group of Medicare mavens with us today. And after their presentations, they are poised to answer your questions. Let's start with Tricia Newman. Tricia is the Vice President of Kaiser Family Foundation and director of its Medicare Policy Project. She's been with the foundation for a dozen years and served on congressional staffs in both the House and the Senate before that. And her assignment today is to give us a broad overview of this important program. Let me just ask each of our panelists, for the benefit of those watching the webcast, as you make reference to a particular slide in your presentation, if you would tell us it's slide number 12, that would be very helpful for those folks who don't have the hard copy don't have the ability to, yes, the hard copy in front of them, be able to flip through it. Trish, thanks very much for being here. We'll look forward to your presentation.
Thank you very much, Ed. And Thank you all for being here to talk about Medicare. I'm going to start with slide one. Funny enough, Medicare was enacted in 1965 at the time the program was needed because about half of all seniors lacked hospital insurance. The program was expanded in 1972 to cover people with permanent disabilities. And in fact, today, about 7 million people on Medicare are under age 65 with disabilities. This is a group that is often not given a lot of attention in some of the policy discussions, but it is one that clearly has some significant needs and relies very much on the program for their basic health coverage. Medicare has four parts, and my job today is going to be to talk about the A, B, C's, and D's of Medicare. It gets a little harder as we add the letters, but we are going to talk about those four parts. In a nutshell, Part A does inpatient hospital care. Part B is physician and outpatient services. Part C is what they, is referred to as the Medicare Advantage Program, which is the term for Medicare HMOs and the other plans that provide Medicare benefits. And Part D is the outpatient prescription drug benefit that went into effect in 2006. Before talking about Medicare, I want to talk about what's not covered by Medicare, just so you know. Medicare, of course, provides important benefits, but does have significant gaps. Most notably, there is no long-term care benefit. There's also no stop loss, no catastrophic benefit for basic A and B benefits, which makes it quite different from the typical plan offered to employees in large firms. Medicare is 13% of the federal budget, and that's important because that means as you or your bosses get involved in work around deficit reduction, it is hard to do work around the budget without thinking of Medicare because it is such a large component. Exhibit 2. This exhibit shows you the diverse needs and circumstances of the Medicare population. As you can see, almost half of all people on Medicare have incomes below twice the poverty level, or about $20,000 for an individual. Many have chronic conditions. Many are in fair or poor health. One particular bar I'd like you to notice is the fairly large share with cognitive impairments, 30%. And I think that's important because if, as you think about changes in the program or making the program work for people who are on Medicare, it's important to remember that many people do need assistance because they're unable to manage. And cognitive impairments includes Alzheimer's disease, or just other impairments that make it hard for people to take their medicines, manage their finances, et cetera. 5% are living in a long-term care facility, and 10% account for 66%, or about two-thirds of all Medicare spending. And that's important to keep in mind because when there's all this discussion about Medicare expenditures, it's important to remember that it's pretty much a small share that are driving most of the spending in the program, and that's typical of health insurance. Exhibit 3, this shows you how the dollars are spent. And what you can see here is about 40% of the dollars spent on benefits go to Part A services. Again, that's inpatient hospital, some skilled nursing facilities, some home health. 34% are for Part B services. That's the physician and outpatient side. 19% are for Part AB. That's the segments at the bottom. These are services that are, we call it Part C, the Medicare Advantage Program, but really these are Part A and B benefits. And so that's why it's displayed that way. And finally, and what's new about this 2006 pie, is you can see 7% of all benefit payments are going for the new Medicare prescription drug benefit. Backing up a little bit on the A, B's, and C's of Medicare in Exhibit 4, you can see in Part A, the hospital insurance program, which now has about 43 million people covered by it, which is paying for the inpatient care. Part A is funded by a payroll tax. And for those of you who look at your payroll stub, you can see that typically employees pay 1.45% and the employer pays the other 1.545%. And that gets to, goes into paying for Part A services. Part B is funded in a different manner. It is a combination of general revenues and beneficiary premiums. And this year, the Part B premium is close to $100, a little bit more than $90 per month, and together they finance Part B services. In addition, this year there is a new income-related premium, which requires people on Medicare with higher incomes to pay a bigger premium, and that has just gone into effect. And finally, there's Part C on this page, which is not separately financed, because as I mentioned before, it's Part A and B benefits combined, so the financing comes from those other two programs. There are 8.5 million people actually in Medicare Advantage plans. Turning to Exhibit 5, I'm going to skip over this fairly quickly because I know we're going to be talking more. Cynthia's going to talk to you more about Part D. But the point of Part D is it's a very different structure than Parts A and B. The benefit is offered by plans that are outside of the traditional Medicare program, either standalone drug plans or integrated Medicare Advantage plans that provide A and B and the new drug benefit. People need to sign up for prescription drug coverage. It's not automatic, which makes it a little bit different from the other plans. Enrollment is voluntary for most people other than those who are on Medicaid who are automatically enrolled in a Medicare drug plan. There is a standard benefit, which I'll show you in a minute, but plan benefits, premiums vary considerably across plans. There are additional subsidies for the low-income population. In fact, many say that these additional subsidies are really a terrific part of the benefit package because it makes the drug benefit affordable for people with low and modest incomes who also meet the asset test. The drug benefit is financed by a combination of premiums, general revenues, and something which is sometimes called the clawback, which is a state financing, which contributes to the overall financing for the program. Exhibit 6 is a diagram of the standard benefit, and as you can see, it's a somewhat of an unusual benefit design. There's a $265 deductible this year in 2007. The plan pays 75%. The enrollee pays 25% of the next $2,400 in drug cost. Then there is the famous donut hole, which you may have heard of. This is a coverage gap. In the coverage gap, the individual pays 100% of their drug costs until they reach a point in which the plan pays almost all 95% of the expenditures. The donut hole this year is $3,051, and as you can see, the donut hole is expected to grow to $3,200 in 2008. Exhibit 7 shows you the Medicare population by source of drug coverage. This is data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which you can see here is about 90% of people are believed to have drug coverage in 2007, half in Part D. Employer plans still play an important role, covering about a quarter of all people on Medicare. And there is some interest in the 9% who are without drug coverage, and some interest in understanding who they are, how to reach them, and how to help them get drug coverage in the following years. Exhibit 8 looks at the low-income subsidy, which I mentioned is one of the most important aspects of the drug benefit. It shows that about half of people getting the subsidy are people who are dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid, so it's giving them additional assistance for the low-income subsidy. Another little bit more than 2 million are getting assistance through the low-income subsidy program, which is generally administered by Social Security. But notably, there are more than 3 million people believed to be eligible for this important assistance who are not receiving it. Turning to future challenges and Exhibit 9, this slide shows you the demographic imperative, which you may have seen before, which is that there are more and more people coming onto Medicare with the aging of the baby boom generation and fewer workers to support aging retirees. So there's clearly a challenge in financing care for an aging Medicare population, and that is something that will no doubt get attention as the trustees release their report, the Medicare trustees next year, talking about Medicare financing. You will hear about two different measures, I feel confident, One is called a Medicare funding warning, which indicates concern with general revenues when they exceed 45% of total. That should get some attention, as with the trustees report, which is predicting when the trust fund will no longer be adequate to pay for Part A benefits. On Exhibit 9, you can see that this exhibit shows you that trust fund projections are important as an indicator of Medicare's fiscal strength, but it also says that Medicare projections are very sensitive both to policy changes and to demographics. Just note two bars here. In 1997, the trustees were projecting that the trust fund would be belly up in 2001. Look down to 2001, and you can see that the trustees were projecting the funds would be adequate through 2030. So with changes in policy, there is a potential, and changes in the economy, there is a potential to keep Medicare stronger for longer. Finally, Exhibit 12 shows sort of summarizes the broad challenges facing Medicare. There are financing challenges. There are challenges related to implementing the drug benefit over time, getting benefits to everyone who needs them, including the low-income subsidies, and making the program work well, both for the hospitals and other providers who are part of the program, but also for the 44 million people who rely on Medicare for their coverage and care.
Thank you, Tricia. We're off to a good start. Now we're going to hear from Tom Ault, who's a principal at Health Policy Alternatives, which is one of this town's most respected health policy analysis firms, which is fitting and proper since Tom has spent years as one of the most respected health policy analysts in town. He's been a senior policy official at what's now CMS, and today he's going to explain some of the intricacies of how Medicare pays different providers. I'm looking forward to this one myself. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Ed. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm nice to have you all here with your interest in Medicare. Is this better? Okay, I can lean into it. That'll work fine. First, before Medicare can make a payment for an item or service, it has to be covered, and that simply means that it has to fit into one of the statutorily covered categories, like a physician service or ambulatory surgery center service or durable medical equipment or inpatient hospital or so on. And it has to be reasonable and necessary. Decisions about whether a service is reasonable and necessary are made according to coverage decisions, and these coverage decisions are both national coverage decisions, and about 10% of all coverage decisions are national. Those are developed by CMS National Office. And local coverage decisions cover about 90% of Medicare's coverage rules. These are developed by local Medicare contractors, which today are mostly the fiscal intermediaries for Part A and the carriers for Part B, which is physician services. We are moving to combine these fiscal intermediaries and carriers into what are called MACs, M-A-C, Medicare Administrative Contractors. Slide 3 shows at the top that we have 81% of Medicare's beneficiaries in Medicare fee-for-service today. As Trish said, about 8.5 million are in some other plan, managed care or some other plan. This shows, gives you kind of an overview of the different types of services. So going from left to right, starting with professional services provided by physicians and other healthcare practitioners, those claims are processed by carriers, and the services are coded according to the American Medical Association's current procedure terminology, or CPT-4. And then equipment and supplies in the middle column are provided by certified Medicare durable medical equipment suppliers who are currently going to be undergoing some competitive bidding. The claims are processed by Durable Medical Equipment Regional Carriers, or DMERCs, and the coding system for that is called HCPCS, stands for Healthcare Common Procedure Coding System. And then lastly, the institutional services, hospitals, nursing home, and home health, those claims are processed by fiscal intermediaries, and the coding system is ICD-9. Going to slide four, now looking at how these different payments are made, what are the rules for making them? When Medicare began in the 1966, payments were based on reasonable costs and reasonable charges. Most Medicare services, almost all Medicare services today, are paid based on a prospective payment system or a fee schedule. So for inpatient hospital, it's diagnosis-related groups, or DRGs. For outpatient hospital, ambulatory payment classifications, or APCs. This will give you some of the alphabet that Medicare is so famous for. So when you hear DRG or APC, you can kind of look this up and know what people are talking about. Skilled nursing facility is a prospective payment system, and it's a per diem system. It is case mix adjusted. And then physician durable medical equipment and clinical laboratory are all paid on fee schedules. Home health is another prospective payment system, but unlike skilled nursing facility, it's for an episode of care. And then covered drugs and biologicals covered under the Medicare Part B program, these are drugs that would be injected or in a physician office or a hospital, those are paid according to average sales price. Cynthia Tudor will be talking about the Part D drug benefit later. Turning to slide five, the physician fee schedule pays out about $75 billion. It was implemented initially in 1993. There's three components to the fee that's paid to a physician. About 53%, or about $40 billion of the total, is for the physician's work. That is what the physician does. About 43% is for the physician's practice expenses, office and related expenses, and that's about $32 billion. And then about 4% is for malpractice insurance, liability insurance, $3 billion. Each component is assigned a relative value, and it's a resource-based system. And these relative values are summed and then multiplied by a conversion factor to get a total payment. An additional point here is that most surgical services are paid based on a global basis. So that means Medicare pays for the surgery and for all services 30 or 90 days following the surgery. Slide six, Medicare today is about the physician payment issue, and this has been going on for a couple of years because Medicare physician payments are overlooking, about to fall off a cliff. The trustees report that was issued a year ago projected 5%, negative 5% updates for the next 9 years. It was 10 years at that time, through 2015. There'll be a new trustees report released next Monday, the 23rd of April, and I think we'll see that they're projecting yet another year of 5% negative updates. These negative updates are driven by something called the Sustainable Growth Rate, or SGR, which limits the year-to-year growth in physician volume and intensity, and when physician services grow faster than this target, then the update is reduced. This chart shows graphically what's happening. The top line is the Medicare Economic Index, which is a measure of the inflation in the cost of providing physician services. So the top line is what it costs physicians to provide their services. The bottom line is the fee schedule's conversion factor. That's the basic rate that Medicare pays. And you can see these lines diverging. Because the conversion factor is going to fall 35% while the MEI is increasing 40%. This is all happening, as I mentioned, because of the sustainable growth rate, This chart, while it looks complicated, it tells a really easy story, I think, and that is that the bottom two lines are just annual. I'm not going to use the pointer. Annual growth in volume and intensity, and the lowest of all is the annual allowance in the SGR. And then the top two lines are the same thing. The top line is the cumulative growth in volume and intensity, and the line under that is the cumulative growth in the allowance. So you can see that every year, actual volume and intensity exceeds the allowance, and you can see that grows over time. Slide 9, fixing the update problem is not easy. If it were, it would have been fixed. It's expensive. Even a 10-year freeze, and when has any provider group or practitioner volunteered to have their payment rates frozen for 10 years? A 10-year freeze in the physician fee schedule would have a federal budget cost of $180 billion and an additional $50 billion in increased beneficiary premiums. There are some administrative changes that that could have been made over the years, but both the current and previous administration haven't made those, and we're stuck with the current situation. As Tricia mentioned, the Medicare beneficiary premium has nearly doubled from $50 in 1997 to $93.50 in 2007. This reflects overall growth in healthcare spending driven by many factors, but it also reflects a shift to more outpatient services. Moving to slide 11, the hospital outpatient prospective payment system is paid according to ambulatory payment classifications, ABC.
I can't hear you. Turn on the mic.
Thank you. I realize I'm using the other mic. Thank you. According to ambulatory payment classifications, or APCs, an APC is roughly equivalent to a single procedure, a clinic, or an emergency room visit, or an item or service like a drug or device. Generally, the outpatient prospective payment system makes a separate payment for each and every item and service. Or service provided during an encounter in the outpatient department. So every service gets a separate payment. This next slide, the top row shows for 2003 to 2006 what the market basket inflation rate has been for hospital outpatient services. And in the far right, you see the cumulative is 14.6%. And then reading down that last column, see the how different types of hospitals have fared over this period, and a couple jump out. Mostly it's been around 14-15% for most hospital types. Rural hospitals have seen their outpatient payments increase almost 21%, and the exempt cancer centers have seen a 4-6% increase. The inpatient hospital prospective payment system is an all-inclusive fixed per-admission payment, and the payment is made for each DRG or diagnosis-related group. It's a bundled payment and includes all services provided during the hospital stay. The guiding philosophy here is that hospitals should make the clinical and economic decisions, not separate price setting by the Medicare program. Cases are assigned to a DRG based on the principal diagnosis, age of the patient, and whether surgery was performed and what type of surgery. And these weights are recalibrated each year by the Medicare program. Looking at, I'm on slide 15, the last slide, some of the current issues facing Medicare payment. Hospital inpatient prospective payment system, a massive proposed regulation was put on display a week ago today, calls for a major change in the DRG system to severity-adjusted DRGs. It also calls for an across-the-board reduction in Medicare's payment of 2.4% a year for 2 years, so for a total of 4.8%. I suspect you're going to be hearing quite a bit about that. The program's justification for that is that they believe switching to this new severity-adjusted DRG system is going to cause what's called case mix creep, inflation in the billing, if you will. And so they're taking an advance adjustment of 2.4% a year for that. Other issues in the inpatient hospital system are whether some of the special adjustments for teaching and disproportionate share hospitals and whether the outlier payment adjustments for especially expensive cases should be maintained or should be changed. Another major area is quality and pay for reporting and value-based purchasing. This cuts across Medicare, physicians, hospitals, home health, and so on. And right now, most of the reporting is pay for reporting for hospitals and physicians and home health. Medicare will be submitting a plan to Congress in June this year for an actual value-based purchasing program for hospitals where they'll have to more than just report, they'll have to achieve certain levels of performance or their payments will be reduced. And then the last major issue is the physician SGR issue, physician update, which I've already discussed. Thank you.
All right, Tom. Tough sledding. That is very dense material. Thanks very much for explaining it. Finally, we're going to hear from Cynthia Tudor, who's the director of Medicare Drug Benefit Group, if we can have the pointer here. Thank you. That group is within the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS. It's the group responsible for making Part D, the drug benefit, work, simply put. She's also helped CMS figure out its payment system for Medicare Advantage plans, no easy task. And today we've asked her to explain how the Medicare drug benefit in Part D actually works. So we're looking forward to that explanation. Cynthia, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Ed. Can you hear me? I'm on slide 2. Prior to January of 2006, Medicare did not cover outpatient prescription drugs except in certain restricted physician settings such as the pneumococcal and flu vaccines and other limited Part B drugs. The Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement and Modernization Act of 2003, which we call the MMA, was signed into law on December the 8th of 2003. For the next approximately year and a half, we worked very hard to come up with a regulation for this and published the final Medicare Prescription Drug Benefit final rule on January 28th, 2005. To tell you how short our time schedule was, approximately 60 days later, we got the applications for 2006. We published the e-prescribing and prescription drug program final rule on November 7, 2005, and that will help with electronic medical records and such things. We published a draft data rule on October the 18th of 2006, which is still in draft. And finally, the Tax Relief and Health Care Act of 2006 provided for the administration of Part D vaccines beginning in 2008. Slide 3. As Tricia talked about, to join a Medicare drug plan, individuals must be entitled to Medicare Part A or enrolled in Medicare Part B, and they must reside in the plan's service area. As she also pointed out, coverage is not automatic, except people who qualify for this via extra help, the low-income subsidy individuals in particular. People who are entitled to Medicare beginning February 1st, 2006 or later have a 7-month period for their initial enrollment in Part D. Our annual enrollment period is from November the 15th through December 31st of each year. Full benefit dual eligibles, which we call FBDEs, lots of good alphabet soup here, can switch plans during any month effective the first day of the following month. And certainly some of our problems in early 2006 were because of this automatic change in plans from month to month. Slide three, what is the low-income subsidy? It provides people who have limited resources and income extra help with their Medicare prescription drug costs, and that includes premium, deductibles, and cost sharing. You must enroll in a Medicare Part D plan to receive this assistance, and you can enroll in a standalone prescription drug plan, which we call PDPs, a Medicare Advantage Part D plan, which we call MAPDs, or the program for coordinated care for the elderly, which we call PACE, to receive this assistance. We work with states to identify the full benefit dual eligibles prospectively, and we enroll them in a Part D plan as soon as they become eligible for Medicare. Slide five, how do people qualify for LIS, or low-income subsidy? People who have Medicare and Medicaid, that is full Medicaid benefits, or who are members of the Medicare Savings Program, will qualify automatically. We get this information from state files, and typically they're deemed for a full calendar year. And we only change their eligibility if they have a more favorable status. That is, they're going from a $2, $5 copay to a $1 or $3 copay. If you're eligible for SSI benefits, we get that information from the Social Security Administration. If you have limited income or resources, you must apply. You must be approved by SSA or by a state, and you could have an event that would change your low-income subsidy status mid-year. As Tricia pointed out, here's our standard benefit for 2007. The top row shows you what total drug spend will be, and the bottom row sort of tells you what the beneficiary is responsible for under the defined standard benefit. This is the benefit that is described in statute, essentially for 2007. It's a $265 deductible, $2,400 is the end of the initial coverage period. You reach catastrophic coverage when you have $5,451.25 and total drug spend. Slide seven shows basically the changes in these kinds of benefit parameters between 2006 and 2007, and we have a new slide for 2008 as well. Each year, the actuaries, bless their hearts, come up with what these changes should look like. So unfortunately for 2008, we actually have some more changes in the $1 LIS co-payment for people at 100% of the federal poverty level. Slide 8 shows you the number of contracts and plans we have for each kind of Part D plan. And we basically have a contract with a major plan, for example, major organization, for example, like Humana or United. And under that are different plan benefit packages. And those plan benefit packages typically apply at a regional level. There are 34 regions in the United States, plus the five territories. Essentially, so we have over 3,700 Part D options for individuals in the 50 states and territories. This slide shows you the four different general types. I'm sorry, it's slide nine, shows you the four different general types of plans that we have. The statute described the defined standard benefit. And that benefit basically says there's 25% cost sharing throughout after the deductible and up until the initial coverage limit. Essentially, this means that a cost share is 25%. For actuarial equivalent plans, they can then take the same kind of benefit, make it actuarial equivalent, and charge copays rather than coinsurance. Basic alternative plans allow sponsors to essentially come up with plans that have lower deductibles than the standard for the year. For example, less deductible than $265 for 2007. Enhanced alternative plans allow a lot more flexibility, but require that the beneficiary pay a supplemental premium. And these would include a reduced deductible to zero, and you'll see many of the plan offerings out there with a $0 deductible. It also allows coverage in the gap. Many plans, including Medicare Advantage, as well as standalone prescription drug plans, are offering enhanced alternative plans. Typically, those plans cover generics through the gap, and a few have covered all drugs on their formulary through the gap. Enrollment by benefit type is showing you, again, our four standard type of plans. This is slide 10, basic alternative. The largest percentage of Medicare Advantage individuals are enrolled in enhanced alternative plans. Typically, those plans are offering zero deductible as well as generic coverage in the gap. The largest single group of PDP enrollees are in basic alternative plans with a large percentage in enhanced plans. For 2007, every state has at least one plan option with a premium less than $20 per month, at least one plan available with no deductible, and several plans with coverage of generic drugs in the coverage gap. On average, our premiums between 2006 and 2007 increased by less than $8 over the 2006 rate, and in several states, we actually had decreases in premium. Beneficiaries have access to between 27 and 41 plans with no deductibles in 2007, and this is an increase over what we saw in 2006. And in every state, the majority of plans does offer mail-order pharmacy services. The number of PDP sponsors, and that is the standalone sponsors, ranges from 20 to 29 per state, and that's an increase over our 2006 level. The number of standalone PDPs offered by these sponsors ranges from 45 to 66. In general, between 06 and 07, we saw the largest increase in enhanced alternative coverage, and that pretty much was because of the effort by CMS to make sure that this happened. We basically see that enhanced plans represent about 50% of the plans in a state. What is a Part D drug? A Part D drug has to be a prescription drug. It must be approved by the FDA for safety and efficacy. It includes biologicals, insulin, and medical supplies associated with the injection of insulin, vaccines, and now vaccine administration, and it must be used for medically accepted indications. We don't cover all drugs. I'm sorry, this is slide 14. We don't cover all drugs. If it is administered or available under Parts A and B, we don't cover it. If it's used for anorexia, weight loss, promoting fertility, cosmetic purposes, symptomatic relief of cough or colds, vitamins, and the important ones are at the bottom, the non-prescription drugs, but also we do not cover barbiturates or benzodiazepines. As of 2007, we also no longer covered ED drugs. What is a formulary? A formulary is a list of drugs that Medicare prescription drug plan must cover without granting an exception. Our formularies for 2008 were due on Monday. We have over 500 formularies to look at for the approximately 3,000 to 4,000 plans we're going to have. The purpose of formularies are to help contain cost. The general requirement for CMS is that the formulary must include at least two drugs in each therapeutic class and a class of covered Part D drugs. These classes and categories are derived for us by the U.S. Pharmacopeia. This formulary, this kind of formulary, would represent to us a floor rather than the maximum number of drugs that have to be covered. We use a number of clinical conditions and other mechanisms to make sure that the formularies are broad and cover the range of conditions that Medicare beneficiaries are likely to have. We allow utilization tools, including prior authorization, step therapy, and quantity limits. Slide 16 shows you Part D enrollment. Again, Tricia covered some of this. We have about 11 million people who are not LIS that are in standard standalone prescription drug plans, and another 5.5 million of the Medicare-Medicaid group, with us, leaving us about 17 million in standalone PDPs. The remaining about 7 million people are enrolled in Part D plans under Medicare Advantage. About 7 million people also are covered under retiree drug subsidy, and we have about 5 million that have additional sources of credible coverage. My last slide shows a number of sources for different kinds of Part D information.
Hey, thank you very much, Cynthia. And it leads us actually into the part of the program where we're going to be asking you to ask the questions, remind you that you have a green card you can use, which we encourage in this context. We will get questions from our folks listening at the webcast and on the conference call as well. You can, for those folks, let me remind you, submit those questions by calling by phone, 202-789-2300. I feel a little like Jerry Lewis here. Or emailing info, at allhealth.org. And a couple of folks submitted questions in advance, and it seemed so appropriate to follow Cynthia's presentation with this one question that I think I'm going to take the liberty of doing that. Have any of the panelists, this person asks, ever tried to explain the prescription drug program to an 80-year-old?
Absolutely. I think the key to doing this is to get the individual to use our either 1-800-MEDICARE help or our Medicare prescription drug plan finder. And I've been able to, over the phone, without even sitting next to the person, be able to lead them through this. But other information is available to beneficiaries at our SHIP, the state health insurance programs, and other local kinds of networks.
Well, Tricia, we'll get to you in a second, but I just ask Cynthia to repeat that phone number.
Oh, I think what phone number? 1-800-MEDICARE.
Okay, that's important to remember. Tricia?
I would imagine that many of you in the room may have tried to help a family member look for a Medicare drug plan. And as Cynthia said, there are two very good resources made available by CMS. One is the telephone number 1-800-MEDICARE. The only place you can get comprehensive information is by going to the website, because that's the place where you can get detailed information not only about premiums and benefits, but also about covered drugs and restrictions, which are fairly important for people who are trying to choose among plans. The problem is that only about a quarter of people on Medicare have ever gone online. So in order to use these resources, people need help from others. And sadly, our research shows that people on Medicare seniors don't really want to ask their children for help on these topics. They may ask their grandchildren, but they're not inclined to ask their children. So there needs to be resources to help and support people with these decisions, because what we also find is that the decision really matters. Choosing a plan is important and can have significant cost implications for someone. There's a big range out there, and everybody's needs vary.
Let me just pursue that for a second, Tricia. What are the counseling programs that are available for people?
Sorry, I should have mentioned that. There are state health insurance programs in every state, and these are really terrific organizations, often staffed by volunteers, and they are set up to help people make these decisions. There are also area agencies on aging. There are also grassroots organizations and nonprofits. I think the issue is getting people to those counselors, because it wouldn't occur to so many people on Medicare to go to what's called a SHIP, these state health insurance programs. So yes, they are out there, but we don't have a sense that people know about them and they aren't using them maybe to the extent that they could.
And is there some central place where people can find out where the SHIP is sailing in their particular state?
Well, Cynthia, you might want to talk about this, but at the back of the Medicare handbook, I believe there is a list of resources, and this is one of the resources that's made available to state-by-state resource list.
I would say that, again, an individual who's sort of all alone is best off trying to go with 1-800-MEDICARE first. 1-800-MEDICARE will actually get on the plan finder, enter the individual's drugs, mail out the finding from the Medicare personal plan finder to that individual so they can then choose. So they are providing more than just talking to the person. They will actually lead them through this plan finder and help them come up with the lowest cost plans according to their prescription drug needs.
One of the questions we've gotten is, could you further explain the donut hole and the reasons and justification for its creation? What effect does this have on beneficiaries needing the most medication?
Well, I'm not into career-limiting moves, so I'm not going to explain the motivation behind the donut hole, except to say that it is a cost-saving move. It was designed that way, and we are simply enforcing the statute. But essentially, the donut hole which we call the coverage gap. Does not provide for coverage of drugs in that part of the benefit. But as I said, a larger and larger percentage of plans are offering some sort of coverage in that period so that beneficiaries can get better access to drugs.
Let me just clarify, if I can. So the coverage gap or the donut hole is in the standard benefit package that's in the statute. Is that right?
It's for 2007. It basically is reached after the initial coverage limit of $2,400 is reached.
So when you're looking for a drug plan and you have the anticipation you're going to get to that threshold, that would lead you to want to have a plan that has some kind of coverage in the gap.
Well, I think, again, that's what the Medicare Personal Drug Plan Finder does for you. If you enter your drugs, it's going to tell you what your costs are going to be in the deductible under each plan option that's available to you, what it's going to look like in the initial coverage limit, whether or not any of your drugs are covered in the gap, and what would happen do you reach catastrophic, and do you reach the coverage gap. So it really tells you all of these kinds of things.
Tricia?
I think it's absolutely true that people who anticipate having high drug costs would benefit from having coverage of brand name drugs in particular in the coverage gap. And it's also true that most of the plans that are out there do not cover brand name drugs in the coverage gap. And even the plans that are doing so this year, I think, are talking about getting out of it for next year because of some of the problems that they've had. So it may be hard for constituents to find a plan that will cover their brands in the coverage gap.
Yes, there's someone standing at each of the two rear of the auditorium mics. So why don't you introduce yourself and try to be as brief as you can.
My name's Matt. I'm from the American Society of Hematology. What's the purpose or rationale for delegating the responsibility for making most coverage decisions to local Medicare contractors?
Tom, you want to take a crack at that?
Sure. That's a great question. It's the local contractors that process all of the claims as they come in. And so when a claim comes in, you have to have a coverage policy for paying it. And so they're the ones processing the claims. They're the ones that know local medical conditions, and so they develop the coverage decisions. Medicare has been moving in the last few years to make more national coverage decisions and to have a better process for doing that, a very open process for doing that. As a deputy administrator of HCFA said a few years ago, having 100% national coverage decisions in Medicare would be like asking, you know, CMS to write a medical textbook every year. I mean, it would be virtually impossible.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, Sean O'Neill with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. I was wondering if there's ever been a score to show what it would cost for Medicare to fill the donut hole, and if so, what was that estimate?
I think we'll have to get back to you on that.
And let me just say, if we have questions like that that are going to require follow-up, we'd be delighted to post answers on our website for people to get back to. Go ahead, Tricia, and then Tom.
I think, as far as I know, there have not been estimates of that released by the Congressional Budget Office in the past few years. That was something that came up before 2003, but I don't believe there are formal estimates that are out there, but we can look and make them available to you after the session.
Diane?
Okay. Tom, this question is, why has there been so much interest in cutting funding to Medicare Advantage to pay for other programs like SCHIP? You've gone into a lot of payment policy. They're questioning what this aspect of Medicare Advantage payments is and why it's being talked about.
I think the reason it's being talked about is that there are a lot of studies showing that Medicare Advantage plans have excessive payments compared to what it costs to provide the care to those patients. So when you make that comparison, and that's the primary reason. I don't know if Trish, if you anyone wants to add anything to that.
Well, certainly, I think another reason is the current environment of PAYGO, where if you want to, I mean, the reference here is to SCHIP. If you need additional funding for the SCHIP program, you either have to come up with the revenues to be increased to pay for SCHIP or to find savings elsewhere, and the Medicare Advantage plans payments are being looked at as one source of financing because of those budgeting rules that the House and Senate are operating under now.
Let me just say, as we go through this question and answer period, those of you in the room, if you would pull out those blue evaluation forms and give us your reactions, as well as to fill out the green question cards, that would be very helpful. And those of you who are tuned into either the conference call or the website, you should have received an evaluation form that you can fax back to us in the materials that were mailed to your office. Or if you go online to allhealth.org, there's an evaluation form that you can print out and fill out and send it back to us if you would. We have a number of other questions on cards. Diane, you want to pick that up?
This one is coming from the field, clearly a constituent issue. Our office continues to receive many letters and calls from constituents who are declined Part B when turning 65 because they already had private insurance through part-time work or spouses. After undergoing medical procedures, they are notified that their second carrier denies their claims, stating Medicare is their primary carrier. Bills continue and frustration mounts. What is being done about this persistent problem so that when people opt out of Part B, secondary carriers will stop denying claims, assuming consumers are on Part B? What can my constituents do to prevent this problem other than posing the question today?
Wow. I think that it would be good to write to the Medicare regional office. There's an ombudsman that can get on that. That absolutely should not be happening. It's definitely a contractor problem. And if the contractor's not responding, then the Medicare regional office ombudsman, I think, would be the person to contact.
Terrific.
Next question, is Medicare sponsoring any programs to encourage electronic medical records?
I mean, Medicare is not directly sponsoring electronic health records in the sense of providing any financial assistance or any financial help in moving to electronic health records. But Medicare has been leading the way in pointing to the importance of that, and there is, as probably you all know, there's been legislation considered. I think it actually passed the House and the Senate, but didn't get through the conference committee in the last Congress, and there will probably be, hopefully, be legislation considered in the current Congress as well.
Okay, we have some people at the microphones. We'll start on my left, if you would identify yourself.
Sure. It's John Weston with United Jewish Communities. Thank you, Ed, for having this wonderful presentation today. A question regarding pay-for-performance. I'm particularly curious as to what accountability hurdles and other challenges, what will the providers face regarding those accountability and other challenges moving forward as we continue with these pay-for-performance implementations?
That's a great question. I mean, because not only Medicare, but Medicaid and private payers all want to be moving more towards value-based purchasing, and that is, you know, not just having a flat rate, but actually being sure that they're getting a certain quality of care and providing incentives to improve the quality of care. The area of Medicare that's the furthest along is the hospital payment system now, where there are 20-some measures that hospitals are reporting on, and that's growing rapidly. And it's envisioned that starting in 2009 that there will actually be an incentive program where a hospital's payment depends on their performance. In for ambulatory care, physician and other ambulatory care, there's a number of measures, and there's actually 74 measures there, but of course with different specialties and so on, they don't all apply to a particular physician. And starting July 1st this year, the physicians will be reporting and will be getting an incentive payment for pay for reporting, which is what hospitals have been doing. There are going to be a number of difficult issues for everyone involved in making this work in terms of keeping measures up to date and also making it a program that has properly aligned incentives and achieves improved quality, which is the ultimate goal we all want.
Carl Eistekel with the National Rural Health Association. I got kind of a two-part question. First part being, with the inversion of population bases of payers and utilizers, do you feel that the economic principles of the Medicare program are maybe backwards? And expanding upon that, if it was reversed, would moving the initial costs of the utilizers address the issue of moral hazard that may be driving up some of these costs?
And somebody better explain what moral hazard is.
Yeah,
those of us who are not actuaries.
You can correct me if I'm not correct comprehending the question you were getting at. I think that what's behind it is a concern about moral hazard, which is, as I'm going to define it right now casually, is when there's insurance for a service, it doesn't do anything to control utilization. It actually tends to increase utilization. And there certainly is a lot of proposals over the years. There have been a lot of proposals over the years for having increased cost sharing and what that would do. But you have the other side of that coin is that when you increase cost sharing, then there are many studies that show that people don't get needed services. And I think what the programs, Medicare and Medicaid, try to do with their different populations and their different needs is to get a reasonable balance between a third-party payer like Medicare or Medicaid paying for the service and having some responsibility for the individual.
Thank you.
We have a series of questions that really do relate back to the Medicare Advantage program. One is, why are there so few people enrolled in Medicare Advantage, and what is the advantage of Medicare Advantage? And then a follow-up that is to discuss the current level of funding for MA plans. If that's cut, what will the result be in terms of its effect on membership and on geographic areas offering these plans? Tricia, you want to start?
On the first question of why so few people in Medicare Advantage plans, there's actually been enormous growth in the past couple of years, from 5 million just a few years ago to 8.5 million today. So after a period of relatively steady enrollment, if you look back historically with about 5% or so, there has been a major increase and in the 90s, and then when payments were modified in the BBA, there was a decline both in the number of plans serving people on Medicare through Medicare Advantage and the number of people signed up. And more recently, there's just been this big increase again, most likely due to a more favorable payment climate. I think another factor has been the drug benefit, which has given some of the companies another marketing opportunity to reach out to people on Medicare and to recruit them to enroll. What are the advantages of Medicare Advantage? Well, that's a big question, and it really depends on the plan. There are many different types of Medicare Advantage plans. There are traditional HMOs. There are special needs plans, which are for targeted populations. There are regional PPOs, which don't have much enrollment. And there's a new type of plan called a private fee-for-service plan, which has actually seen tremendous growth just in the past 2 years, going from 200,000 people, virtually no one in a 44-million person program, to 1.5 million this year. So there are different programs and different plans, and the different plans offer different benefits. So it's pretty hard to generalize about the advantage of Medicare Advantage. But because of the payments that, as Tom said, have been relatively generous when compared to traditional Medicare, plans are able to offer extra benefits to people who sign up, and for some that is very attractive, particularly people who feel they can't afford, for example, a Medigap premium. So that can be an advantage depending on what the benefit is. There is discussion about cutting payments to plans, and that could have some effect. It could mean that some of the newer plans in payment areas that see a reduction don't stay around for long. It's hard to say for sure. It could mean that the benefits are no longer as generous and as favorable as they are this year. But I think an important point to remember is that Medicare Advantage serves as the questioner said, it's a minority of people who are on Medicare. And when you think about the issues around benefits, it's important to remember that the majority of people on Medicare are not choosing Medicare Advantage plans yet. And so the issue of protecting benefits in Medicare Advantage might be thought about also in a broader context of remembering to provide benefits in an equitable way to people both in Medicare Advantage and traditional Medicare.
This is a question related to the wisdom of installing systematic cost-effectiveness studies for payment and coverage decisions instead of relying exclusively on the contractors, or how are these decisions really made?
Now it is. Okay. I guess I need training in how to push a button. Cost-effectiveness studies are, and just plain old effectiveness studies, evidence-based medicine type studies, are used both by Medicare in making national coverage decisions and by the local carriers. They're used as a guidance because Medicare cannot explicitly choose to not cover a service because it falls below some cost effectiveness threshold. And so what the way Medicare decision makers will more likely use these cost effectiveness studies is in a comparative effectiveness way, but even there I think, as the questioner probably knows, there's been a great reluctance to actually deny coverage or to limit payment. In a couple of cases, Medicare has implemented what's called least costly alternative, and that is where they have two items, say two drugs, and if one drug is not shown to be any better than the other drug, then Medicare will say, well, we're not going to pay any more for the more expensive drug than for the cheaper drug. We'll limit our payment. And those kinds of decisions could be increasing over time, but we don't have very many of them now.
Can I just do a commercial here? A week from today, the Alliance will be doing a briefing on comparative effectiveness and the state of the art in that area, not necessarily tied to Medicare, but certainly related to it. You'll be getting that announcement probably on Monday.
Okay. This is a caller question. What does the panel suggest clients who use specialty drugs do with the deductible if their drugs average $2,000 and Part D only covers 80%. Prior to Part D, the drug assistance program allowed them to receive drugs for free or at a minimal cost.
Well, CMS is aware of this problem. We've been working with pharmaceutical assistance programs, which I think is what the caller is referring to see what kinds of special programs they can still put in place. These drugs, these expenditures by the PAP, or pharmaceutical assistance program, may or may not apply to the beneficiary's true out-of-pocket cost counter, depending upon how that PAP is operating. I think still the best news right now is to get in touch with the individual pharmaceutical assistance program and see under what conditions they can still provide these drugs if the beneficiary is in either the coverage gap. I think in my mind, once you hit $2,000, say a month, you're going to be in catastrophic coverage fairly fast, typically now in the second month or so. So I think then catastrophic will kick in and you'll be paying 5% of the cost, which I understand is not a small amount of money when you have such high drug expenditures.
Yes, would you like to ask your question from the microphone?
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Christopher with the Administration for Children and Families. I'm interested in hearing more about the low-income subsidy program and specifically how the automatic enrollment works in relation to selecting the plan if the applicants are working with a caseworker and trying to determine which plan to enroll with. I'd also like to hear about the outreach efforts to try to specifically target the vulnerable populations and whether or not there has been outreach involving the medical community in trying to identify these vulnerable populations and referring them to the program. Thank you.
The first question, I think, was about how we find out about the low-income subsidy people. We essentially work with states. We get state files, both of their current LIS people and other LIS and prospective LIS people, and essentially work to get them randomly assigned to plans as required by statute. If a state wants to work with us, it's typically on an SPAP kind of function.
Are you on a what?
State Pharmaceutical Assistance Program basis, alphabet soup, you know, it's great. If the state wants to work with us on something like a State Pharmaceutical Assistance Program, once they are operating within our rules, we can work with them to use a different kind of assignment approach. But generally, because our formularies are very, very broad, and I don't want to minimize how broad they in fact are, most individuals can find therapeutic alternatives on any formulary to which they are assigned. On the second issue, which was, I think, outreach, I'm not the outreach expert here, given I'm the operational person, but essentially there have been hundreds and hundreds of fairs that CMS has held, where they are working with local providers, local advocacy operations, all kinds of different groups to make sure that we are reaching out to identify as many low-income people as we can and to get them into the program.
Tricia, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to back up for people who are helping people who are on Medicaid and have been randomly assigned to a plan. The process of assigning people to a drug plan does not take into account what their needs might be, which drugs they use. So if someone is assigned to a plan, it's very important to look at the formulary to make sure that the drugs they take are covered. And if not, look for an alternative plan that accepts people with low-income subsidies. That's very important for making sure that people can stay on the medications that they depend on. And in terms of outreach, Social Security has I think, taken the lead for the government in doing outreach. But I think they have discovered how hard it is to reach out and find people, and that's why there are an estimated 3 million people out there who could be benefiting from this assistance but still are not getting it.
The Trent Martinstein, private HIPAA consultant. The tragedy in Virginia this week points to the need of adequate mental health care. Most major psychiatric illnesses have been shown to be biologically based, and there's incredibly new evidence such that people who are depressed and have a heart attack die much more quickly if they don't get antidepressant treatment. I've noticed that of all the medical procedures or treatments here, psychiatric care is covered at 50% coinsurance, where all the other medical treatments are close to 20%. So my question is, and also 50% is a lot of money for patients in need to pay, and particularly the chronic population of schizophrenics and other chronic mental illnesses also don't really have that kind of funding. So my question is, are you considering putting mental health benefits on parity with other medical benefits? I think that's my question.
You're absolutely right about the 50% coinsurance for mental health visits. There has been legislation proposed over time that would bring that coinsurance down to 20% to be parallel to what other physicians are receiving. I think the issue there is costs, because it would add cost to the program, and that's probably the biggest barrier.
I'm strongly in favor of mental health parity myself, and it's greatly needed. I did want to make an additional point that certain visits, that is medication management visits for psychiatric care, are covered at a 20% coinsurance rate, and the drugs that the beneficiary would be getting would be covered most likely under their Part D plan if they're enrolled in Part D. So it's a little better than it had been, but we got a long ways to go.
Thank you.
This is a caller question. Can anyone over the age of 65 opt out of Part A? And also, why is enrollment in Part A automatic?
You're enrolled in Part A automatically, and I guess I'm not sure why someone would want to opt out of Part A.
What about cost?
Because there's no premium. If you've been paying into Part A, if you've been paying your payroll tax when you turn 65, there's no monthly premium. So it's not clear why you would want to turn down the coverage that you could get.
In fact, some people opt to buy into Part A as opposed to opt out of it. Okay. A question also, for medications that are covered under Part B, how is the average sales price set? How are decisions made to cover or exclude drugs under that part of the Medicare? So not in the Part D program, but in the traditional Part B.
Yeah, the average sales price for injected and infused drugs is set based on reports that manufacturers are required to file with Medicare quarterly. And in these reports, they list all their total sales in dollars and their total units in as a number, and those are divided to get an average sales price. And with a two-quarter lag, Medicare lets that be the rate.
This one gets a little political, but we'll do it anyway. What is the purpose rationale for providing drug benefits, Part D, exclusively through the private sector as opposed to through the public or private sector as with Parts A, B, and C?
Want to try another one of those career enders?
Career moves, right. those are called CLMs, just to keep the alphabet soup up. The Congress that passed this law was interested in private sector solutions to the drug, to the outpatient drug prescription problem. They sought private sector solutions. They were able to get it through Congress, and that is why it is what it is. I would say that Part C is a private sector solution as well. You're looking for private plans that offer drug benefits. So these are not, you know, this is a different, it's a way of offering different options to Medicare beneficiaries, not just one offered by the government, but one available to individuals, for example, in the commercial market. So I think the feeling was, if you are using a certain kind of provider when you're under 65, why should all care be provided through a government solution once you reach 65?
Okay, and this question?
Tricia had an additional comment.
The distinction between Part C and Part D is, in Part C, people, of course, have the option to be in traditional Medicare for their Medicare benefits or a Medicare Advantage plan. In Part D, people really do need to choose either the standalone plan or a Medicare Advantage plan to get their drug benefit because it's not available under traditional Medicare.
Okay. What causes the wide swings in solvency dates of the trust fund, 4 years to 10 years, and what options exist to address these solvency swings? And perhaps one can also comment on explaining the 45% trigger.
Well, there are a number of factors. That's a good question. And what explains these swings? It's certainly it's not anything to do with the trustees and whether they were right or wrong 1 year. It has more to do with the economy. Remember that the money that goes into the trust fund is from payroll taxes. So in good years, when salaries go up, there's more money that goes into the trust fund. That is a major factor. Changes in policy also matter. So, for example, if Congress chooses to modify payments to hospitals, slow the growth in future years, that's going to affect the future obligations of the trust fund. That, too, has a big effect. Another factor is shifts in care. If care was more on the inpatient side and it moves more to the outpatient side, that takes the burden off of the part of the program that pays for inpatient care. So there are real reasons why there are fluctuations, and those are just three examples. In terms of options for helping out the trust fund, Congress has come back year after year with changes in policies that affect provider payments that come out of the trust fund. That's payments to hospitals, payments to skilled nursing facilities, home health, and hospice. And every time Congress slows the growth in payments to those facilities, that breathes new life into the trust fund. And so that's a very clear thing that can be done to help the financial outlook there. In terms of that solvency trigger, which is pretty new and pretty complicated to explain, this is a new measure that was put into law that says when general revenues, which is a portion of Medicare financing, is projected to exceed 45% of total spending, and that projection is made by the trustees 2 years in a row, then a funding warning is set off. And so last year was the first year that the trustees, in fact, projected that that Medicare general revenues would exceed 45% of the total. I think it's 6 years from now. If the trustees next week issue the same warning, so that would be the 2 years in a row, that sets off a set of requirements, and the president is required to submit a proposal to the Congress within a year for expedited consideration. So next week when the trustees release their report, this will be an important thing for you to look for, because that will affect what transpires over the course of the next year or so.
And then moving to Part B, which is not part of the trust fund, we have a question here about, for Tom, what options exist to address the physician payment problem, the SGR problem, besides just more dollars?
That's a very good question.
You should be clear about, for those who are really at the basics, what's in the Part A trust fund that Tricia just talked about versus how Part B is financed.
Yeah. As Tricia said, Part A is primarily hospitals, inpatient services, skilled nursing facilities, and home health agency benefits. Part B is physician, hospital outpatient, ambulatory surgery center, clinical lab, and Part B drugs, excuse me, the injected and infused drugs, and a number of other items, the ESRD program also, for example. One question to ask about the physician target is this SGR target that is this a reasonable level in physician spending? Is just way out of control, or is the level maybe too low? And the allowance in the SGR is for growth in the economy, real GDP growth. That's the limit in the SGR.
Excuse me, Tom. Let me do this one.
Okay.
SGR stands for sustainable growth rate, right?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Ed. And the limit is GDP growth. Since the in the whole history of the Medicare program since 1966, only when the physician fee schedule was implemented in 1993 and a couple years thereafter was growth at 2% or less, which is about what the economy grows a year, 2.1%. And in fact, when this limit was enacted, Congress and the administration President Clinton at the time, and the advisory bodies of Congress all suggested that the limit should be GDP plus a higher number. So the limit is probably too low. That's not going to find the revenues, though, to get the problem fixed. The Medicare Payment Advisory Commission issued a report a couple of months ago, maybe just back in March, actually, on options for addressing this. And one of their options involves expanding these growth targets to encompass not just physicians, but all health spending. So hospitals, home health, you would have geographic targets, regional targets for all of Medicare with feedback mechanisms and so on to try to attack this in a more holistic way.
Okay, this is a question regarding the Part D benefit again. I have heard of beneficiaries who have withdrawn from a Part D plan, but they are still having their premiums taken out of their Social Security check. This is a problem. Is there some way to address this? Can you explain what's going on?
When an individual enrolls in a Part D plan, that individual selects whether or not they want to have direct pay or they want to have Social Security withhold their Part D premium. What seems to be happening is that when individuals change their minds and they either want to go on direct pay or alternatively they actually want to withdraw from the plan, the timing of various company systems are not in sync. And that is, the individual may withdraw from a plan on the 31st of the month. That obviously is not going to reach Social Security in time for that month, for the next month's checks, because it must first go to the plan and then to CMS. There is even a likelihood that it may miss the following month's deadline. So it's an issue of making sure all this is synced. Obviously, any beneficiary who is having these kinds of problems needs to first get in touch with their plan, make sure that plan has this problem in their database. It's not their fault, I'm not saying that, but simply they start there, and then CMS and the plan and the regional offices in particular can work to get that beneficiary's problem solved.
Okay, and as a final question from the field, some physicians will not accept MA plans. Are there any plans in CMS or other options to deal with this issue?
We're talking about Medicare Advantage plans?
Right.
Okay.
You want me to take it?
Sure.
Medicare Advantage plans are all different types, as Tricia pointed out. I think most plans have contracted providers. Most HMOs do. Most of the PPO options do. So most plans have contracted providers, and they simply work with that group of contracted providers. The group of the kind of plan that does not have a set of contracted providers are private fee-for-service plans. And in those circumstances, the physician can determine on a case-by-case basis whether or not they want to accept that patient and then decide to or not. I don't know of any legislation or any change that's requiring people to accept a Medicare Advantage contract.
So getting back to, you know, what this means for constituents, this is a real issue when thinking about choosing a plan. It really puts a little bit of a burden on the beneficiary to talk to their providers, all their doctors. Lots of people in Medicare have more than one doctor, to find out whether their doctor will accept payment from that plan. maybe even find out about the local hospital, because we know that seniors tend to prefer certain hospitals, because the last thing they want to find out over the course of the year is they're going to have a problem with payments when they need, after they have received a service.
I think that we have gone through the majority of your questions. I hope that your questions have been answered. I find it interesting that today's Medicare discussion had more alphabet soup than the previous Medicaid discussion, and may have even been more complex, which is not something that everyone assumes when they look at Medicare versus Medicaid. We did get a few questions that asked us to speculate on how Medicare would fit in with universal coverage and other proposals. We are saving that for a follow-up discussion, because we were just really today trying to do the basics. But on behalf of the Kaiser Foundation, we did get a lot of great questions, and we especially thank those of you watching with the webcast. Ed?
Let me add the thanks of the Alliance, not only to those of you who watched on the webcast, those of you who sat through it here in Washington, and ask all of you to fill out those evaluation forms so that we can make the next one we do even better. And add also that we had a panel that fielded an incredible variety and complexity of questions, and I'd like to ask all of you in the room anyway, so we can hear you, to join me in thanking that panel.